Yeah, well, this maybe does pick up a little bit on the first talk. The scientific revolution, among the most conspicuous of the revolutions which opinions on this subject have undergone, is the transition from an implicit trust in the internal powers of man's mind to professed dependence upon external observation. That's an analysis by William Whewell of what the scientific revolution was. And of course, I mean, this is the key point here, the significance of empirical evidence to drive science. But frankly, this doesn't pertain in theology. To read scripture with one eye on any other account is to blur its image and miss its wisdom. To have God's own presentation on human origins as they most deeply concern us, we need to look no further than these scriptures and their New Testament interpretation. Now, Derek Kidner was actually very sympathetic to scientific explanations of Genesis. And perhaps one feels that he said this out of political correctness, but I still feel that these are very wrong things to say, and they have consequences. If science is not allowed to apply any constraints to biblical interpretation, then the result is it will rise up and steal the place of theology. It will try to claim that it's the source of ultimate truth rather than assisting us in understanding what the Bible has to say. I'd argue that this is one of the great drivers of the new atheism. For example, Christopher Hitchens, he lists four so-called irreducible objections to religious faith, and in actual fact, the first two really are origins problems. That religious faith wholly misrepresents the origins of man and the cosmos, and the second one is merely a restatement of that observation. So this shows how critical it is, which doubtless most people here agree, for science to say the right thing to theology, that scientific constraints should be correctly applied. Now, when I wrote my abstract, I was thinking I'd be giving a poster. I was absurdly ambitious in the number of issues I raised. So I decided to focus on a single example of this to hopefully do it in a bit of detail. The flood. You might think there was nothing new to say about the flood. It's been talked over endlessly, and millions of dollars have been spent on TV shows looking for the ark. I would say there's a very strong polarization of opinion about the flood. We have the creationist view, like what we might call flood geology. All the sedimentary strata are laid down by a global flood. All the humans except Noah's family died. At the opposite pole, I would argue, we have basically views which suggest the flood's kind of a parable. Paul Seeley, the flood, not global, barely local, mostly theological, which is really the same as John Golingay. I assume the flood is basically a parable, is what he means here, a parable rather than a historical story. Now, these are not really people you'd normally term liberals, perhaps. They're evangelicals, but really, they're taking a liberal position that the flood is principally just a story. Well, is there any possibility of a middle path here which is consistent with science? Well, firstly, we can demolish the first thing easily. The flood can't be global because the ancients didn't know about the globe. Okay, get rid of that. Geologists would clearly say that geology refutes the concept that all the sedimentary rocks were laid down by the flood. The problem is, if we can't give a plausible explanation of the flood, then we should expect that the public who's not educated in geology is going to go, if they're believers, if they're Christians, they have no option but to go for so-called flood geology. So why does Paul Seeley describe the flood as mostly theological? Okay, so he had essentially, this may not be accurate, but this is my best attempt to repeat his argument. This was in the Biologos Forum. Firstly, the Sumerian king list places the flood immediately before the kingdom of Kish around 2900 BC. Yep, that's good. Mesopotamian stories agree with the king list. Yes. The biblical flood story was almost certainly based on Mesopotamian flood stories. Yes. There is evidence for a medium-sized flood around Kish at this time. Yes. Therefore, the biblical flood story must be a theological exaggeration. Well, why do I say no? Well, now, I'm a believer in taking the king list seriously, the Sumerian king list seriously, but we have to realize it was composed hundreds of years after the flood at Kish. So if you imagine reconstructing events, you know, now that were 700 years ago, with extremely rudimentary written records, they had no idea about precise chronology of their past. It's very, very plausible that the Mesopotamian accounts conflated more than one flood event. Anachronistic conflation is very common and easy to do. The story of Babel is a good example. So the story of the Tower of Babel presents Babel as the tower has been built long before the time of Abraham, except that Babylon barely existed. It was like a village at the time of Abraham. And so therefore, the biblical account of the Tower of Babel has conflated two different concepts, an early attempt to build a tower and a city with a much later identification with the ziggurat of Babylon. So this is an example of how conflation, anachronistic conflation, can very easily occur. So we shouldn't take this as strong evidence that the biblical flood occurred at 2900 BC, which would imply that it was barely significant. On the other hand, the biblical account describes the flood as cataclysmic. Any attempt to take the biblical account seriously must show it washed away all the mud brick temples of Mesopotamia, because they would just turn back to mud. And the oldest of these structures goes back to 550 BC. So I suggest any serious geological constraint, scientific constraint, should put the flood before 550 BC. Okay, well, we can have a look at a bit of geological evidence. The Mesopotamian plain, one of the largest delta plains on Earth. It's extremely flat over a very large area. This is the 50-meter contour. This is 500 kilometers here. If anywhere was going to have a catastrophic flood, this would be the place. Okay, well, there is evidence for when a flood could have occurred. For example, we want to know, for example, when the Tigris and the Euphrates would have likely flooded. We can look at severe rainfall events in their headwaters. Well, it just so happens there's a lake in the headwaters, between the headwaters of these two rivers, Lake Van. It's a very kind of special kind of lake. It's a terminal lake, meaning it has water inflow but no exit, like the Dead Sea. As such, it records rainfall variations. And what it shows is a massive peak of rainfall, 6000 BC. The other way we can approach this is we can look at the sedimentary record for Iraq, which is incredibly understudied. So here's a sediment log from near the city of Ur. And what it shows is two different strata that look like a flood. This one here could be Leonard Woolley's flood stratum, 4300 BC, and this is what this author identified as a major marine transgression, in other words, marine flood, 6000 BC. Okay, a sun marine transgression, what would cause that? The most likely explanation is an earthquake. What these flood fault plane solutions show is the black part of this quadrant means the first motion of an earthquake is downwards. So what this means is the Mesopotamian plain is very likely to have undergone downward movement during an earthquake and be accompanied by liquefaction of sediment. This should conjure in your mind the phrase, all the fountains of the deep burst open. So this is what the author here, Araqui, interpreted as the history here. In the history of Mesopotamia, which was generally very dry, one period when there was a marine transgression at the same time as heavy rainfall. This is like the perfect storm, and it's very strong scientific evidence that Mesopotamia would have flooded at that point. So we have very strong empirical evidence here for the flood. If Noah had not been saved by the flood, the knowledge of God would have disappeared from the earth. Since this flood was local, God was not actually concerned with the preservation of the human race. He was concerned with the preservation of his revelation, and this has implications for the rest of Genesis. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Before I invite questions, we've got a couple of minutes. Is Doug Hay over here? Could you come and be getting yourself hooked up? And while you're doing that, this paper is open for brief comment or question.
Okay, so it's very widely believed that belief in the true God died out before the time of Abraham, based on whatever is said in Joshua about the fact that Abraham's ancestors were pagans. But I mean, this is an over-interpretation of that text. So maybe they believed in other gods, but that doesn't mean to say no one knew about the true gods. So it speaks of the preservation of the revelation of the true God through the history of Mesopotamia. And that has huge implications for biblical interpretation.
You mentioned that Noah guaranteed, if you will, the persistence of the God's revelation, are you using this argument locally to whatever area the flood was restricted to? Because I thought I heard you say that you rejected a global flood, in which case that argument of preservation of revelation by Noah would be applicable only to the restricted area of the flood.
Well, yeah, the Mesopotamian plain, but I think I don't know of any evidence that that religion in any pure form went outside Mesopotamia. So I would say a flood that destroyed all of Mesopotamia would have destroyed the knowledge of the true God, such as we believe that there was. We don't really know in detail, but that would be my argument.
Very quickly, because we've got to move on. Yes.
What is this say about the local inerrancy?
That's too big a issue for 10 seconds.
Talk over lunch. And Alan, thank you very much.